Consumers are as pessimistic as economists right now. One weekly measurement of consumer confidence shows it hovering close to its all-time low. There was a tiny uptick in consumer confidence last month because gasoline prices eased a bit. But yesterday that turned around. The price of oil, which leads to the price of gas, of course, jumped more than $5.50 per barrel to $122. NPR's John Itzstein reports that hostile rhetoric between Russia and the United States and its allies is behind this price spike.
Russia is the world's second largest oil producer. It supplies a quarter of the European Union's oil and half its natural gas. Energy consultant Jim Ritterbusch of Ritterbusch & Associates says that's why the political flare-up over Georgia and U.S. missiles in Poland has rattled oil traders.
It's conjuring up images that the entire oil pipeline system that goes through Georgia could be disrupted again.
Oil prices had actually dropped about 25% over the past couple of weeks from a record $147 a barrel. But that downward trend has been reversed over the past few days.
This bellicosity on the part of Russia is tending to drive a lot of renewed geopolitical risk premium back into the oil pricing structure.
Analysts say that political risk premium has added about $10 to the cost of a barrel of oil above the pure supply and demand price. A reduction in that premium had been a significant part of the slide in oil prices in recent weeks, as tensions with Iran seemed to ease and disruptions in Nigerian oil fields diminished. Jim Ritterbusch thinks this new upswing in the price of oil will be short-lived and that reduced demand will force oil prices lower again. John Itzstein, NPR News, Washington.
If you're shopping for a house in the most remote suburbs, it's a good time to buy.
Hi, Ryan. I have very good news for you.
That's the sound of a sales agent calling a potential buyer.
You excited?
Robin Chase is negotiating the purchase of a home lot 53 miles outside Philadelphia. The development is advertising price cuts of up to $87,000.
You would be absolutely psychotic not to sit down and absorb this and not move forward.
You might wonder why developers would be psychotic enough to build out here. The farthest suburbs have suffered so much from falling home prices and expensive gas, it raises the question of whether Americans can continue their habit of suburban sprawl. We got a surprising answer when we put that question to the urban historian Witold Rybczynski.
Does it make any sense to build anything this far out at this point?
Somebody's building down the street here. So the answer is yes, it makes sense to some people.
Even now, as we're about to hear, developers are making big plans in Chester County, Pennsylvania. That's where we're reporting the next two mornings on The Urban Frontier, our series on how the world's cities develop and grow. We've charted the way cities like Karachi and Mumbai are handling their explosive growth. In American cities, you often find the fastest changes at the edges of metropolitan areas, like in Chester County. It seems remote until you visit a certain county office, where a child's lined paper hangs on the wall.
My dad works at the planning office.
That's a homework assignment decorating the office of Ronald T. Bailey.
He plans where a new house will be. He also plans where the new building will be, by Adam B.
Adam, that was when he was in the first grade.
The dad who was featured in that first grade paper unrolls a laminated map for us.
And I had my staff produce this from north of New York to south of Washington, D.C., and you can see where Chester County is located. And
it shows more than Chester County. It shows a good portion of the northeastern United States.
If you really take some perspective and stand back a little bit and look at this from space, you realize that we're really dealing with a metropolitan complex that extends from Boston in the north and Richmond to the south, and Chester County is right in the middle of that.
On Ronald Bailey's map, Chester County is not at the urban fringe, even though parts of it are more than 50 miles from Philadelphia's Liberty Bell. Instead, Chester County is the center, within driving range of several big cities, which is exactly how Rick Durr sees it. We met him in the driveway of the house he bought in Chester County.
It's actually halfway between my job and my wife's job. I work outside of Baltimore, and my wife works right outside of Philly.
It's hardcore commutes.
It's big commutes. 70 miles for mine one way and 47 for her.
Even though gas prices hurt them, it's not so easy to just move closer to work. He wants to keep his job at a pharmaceutical company. She wants to keep teaching at a private school. They're in opposite directions. And that's no surprise to Witold Rybczynski, whose book Last Harvest traced some of Chester County's development.
My friends who are sort of very pro-urban see, you know, the high gas prices as a terrific boost to urban living. I'm not so sure. As a culture, we've really bought into the notion of spreading out, and we're going to do our darndest to make it work.
American cities are spreading so far that they're starting to merge into what are sometimes called mega regions. Cincinnati is stretching closer to Columbus. Phoenix is creeping toward Tucson. In the Northeast Corridor, in one of those areas between cities, planner Ronald Bailey has been watching Chester County's population climb rapidly toward 500,000.
Given our location and given transportation facilities through this area, we're going to continue to see a lot of demand for development. The challenge is going to be to accommodate that development in ways that create a more sustainable community.
Notice, though, that Bailey said sustainable community. He doesn't think the farthest suburbs can keep on expanding exactly as they always have.
Has the price of gas altered the way that you look at this map and think about what you want to be on this map in 10 years?
Well, combine the increase in the price of gas with the increased awareness of the bad effects of greenhouse gas emissions, and it is making a change.
Ronald Bailey is hoping today's economy will intensify efforts to build a different kind of suburb. Maybe you don't need every house to be on a one-acre lot. Maybe people don't want to drive every single place they go. A different Chester County is already under construction in a few places, like the massive construction site where we met a local developer.
Hi, Brian O'Neill. How are you?
Brian O'Neill's earth movers have flattened a good portion of Malvern, Pennsylvania.
Probably if we step up on this mound of dirt, it'd be the best vantage point.
This is huge. We've got a highway on one side, we've got a hillside on the other side that earth movers are digging into, and you've got activity almost as far as you can see. I mean, over to these light poles several hundred yards away. How many acres is this?
This is over 100 acres, and we're spending $540 million on the site.
Brian O'Neill looks a little like the actor Jack Nicholson when he smiles. He accents that look with dark sunglasses, a blazer, and an open-collared shirt.
What we're doing is providing a new town center for all of the commerce and residential development that's occurred in this neck of the woods over the past 100 years.
A new town center. That's what O'Neill is building on the site of a former steel mill. It's surrounded by busy corporate campuses, companies like Vanguard and Wyeth. The development will follow principles of what's called new urbanism. You pack homes, offices, and stores close together so people can walk.
This will be just like a village when it's finished.
What's that mean?
Well, there'll be lots of meandering cross streets. All of the cafes and restaurants will have outdoor dining. Each of the buildings has residential component above the retail so that people actually will live here. You'll be able to live, work, and play here like the early villages in the United States.
Take a look at the plans, and you do see compromises. The retailer Target is part of this project, sort of. Its big box store will sit off by itself, way across a giant parking lot, in the manner of suburban Targets everywhere. But overall, O'Neill believes he is shaping a project that will outlast this tough economy.
You know, there's never a good time to not start a development. If you have all the components, starting with location, 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 then it pays to proceed.
It sounds like you think the far-out suburbs are sustainable, even if there is $4 gas, $5 gas.
Well, this is not a far-out suburb. You know, you're on the absolute bullseye of commerce in the state of Pennsylvania right here. Just look around.
30,000 people work within walking distance. Hundreds of thousands live within a short drive in Chester County, Pennsylvania.
And that's why we decided to proceed despite the state of the economy.
What used to be the edge is now the center. That's what O'Neill is counting on most to get him through a changing world. We're on the urban frontier, reporting on how our metropolitan areas grow. And tomorrow we'll hear how an ex-urban development struggles to be sustainable.
A layoffs are an inevitable part of an economic slowdown, and nowadays a growing number of companies are laying people half off, that is, cutting their jobs to part-time. Under a little-known program called work sharing, offered in a handful of states, those employees can still collect unemployment for the hours that are cut back. Kurt Nickisch has the whole story from member station WBUR in Boston.
In the small seaside town of Gloucester, Massachusetts, business has been so slow at this sheet metal shop, there's often only one machine running at a time. Bernard Savo runs this place called Modern Heat. He says the sluggish economy has really cooled sales.
When we didn't have enough money to come in to take care of the payroll, we knew that we had to do something on this end to cut the overhead. The insurance still goes on, the electric still goes on, but the payroll was what was killing us.
Normally, cutting payroll means cutting jobs. But Savo did not want to lose experienced workers, only to have to hire and train replacements when orders pick back up again. So he signed up with the state for work sharing. Instead of laying off part of his workforce, Savo's laying everyone off part-time.
If I had to work, I'd put them back to work full-time. I have no choice but to keep them working for 3 days a week and then unemployed for two.
Savo's employees still draw full benefits under work sharing, health care, and retirement, but for the 2 days they're not on the job, they get unemployment from the state.
We can bump that end out a little bit.
On the shop floor, Savo's staff is pretty torn about the plan. Longtime employee Alex Minnell says the unemployment he gets only makes up about half of what he would have been earning those 2 days.
I don't have a family or a mortgage, so I'm not in too bad shape. And it comes at a time of the year where it's sort of nice to have some extra time off. But in general, I'm running on my savings, so it's dropping.
The drop was too much for another employee with a family. The welder took another job. Still, the rest have stayed on, resigned that a 3-day work week is better than a no-day work week.
It's good for the economy here because these people do have a job to go back to.
That's Edward Malmberg. He heads Massachusetts unemployment system and says the number of people in work sharing here has shot up by more than a third so far this year. Many of the 17 other states that offer part-time layoffs are seeing big increases too. In Florida, the number has tripled. Malmberg says companies want the flexibility to bring employees back to full time as soon as the economy gets better.
That's what we really like to see. It doesn't always work out, but in a large number of cases, we've seen that it has.
Malmberg says part-time layoffs don't appear to drain the state's pool of unemployment money any more or less than conventional pink slips, but work sharing's not necessarily a wash for the companies themselves.
The downside is that the costs don't fall proportionally with the hours.
Paul Osterman is a labor market economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He says businesses don't save as much money up front as they would through regular layoffs.
If you have to still maintain benefits and so on, two half-time people are more expensive than one full-time person.
Osterman says companies have to weigh that against the savings that work sharing brings down the road by not having to rehire. He says the shorter the economic downturn is, the more part-time layoffs pay off. The big jump in work sharing recently suggests companies are betting the slowdown will be short-lived. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch.
Next, we're going to one of the parts of the country where houses remain very, very expensive. It's one of those attractive places where Americans are flocking by choice, places where many buy second homes, by the beach, in the mountains, or in college towns. The newcomers often outbid the locals for real estate. Today, we pay a second visit to Flagstaff, Arizona, which is a tourist gateway to the Grand Canyon. We're also going to visit Winslow, Arizona, 60 miles away, which is being revitalized by the Flagstaff residents who can no longer afford Flagstaff. Our story comes from Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker.
Ruth Thomas is soaking in the view from the outskirts of Flagstaff. Her big picture window is a perfect frame for the mountains nearby.
I can see all that Flagstaff has to offer. I can see Mount Eldon, I can see the peaks, I can see trees. I'm surrounded by beauty.
Thomas grew up with this view. She moved back from Tucson recently and runs a daycare center, but she can't afford to buy a house. She can't even afford to rent an apartment.
Flagstaff's beautiful. It's where I want to raise my children. It's safe. And ever since I've been back home, it's been very difficult to find a place to live.
That's partly because Flagstaff has been discovered by wealthy second homeowners, and partly because so many jobs here are in tourism and retail, which don't pay very well. Home prices have more than doubled this decade. Now only about one out of every five families can afford the median price, $350,000. So Ruth Thomas has done something three of her four siblings did. She and her children moved back in with her parents. Sue Norris, a retired school teacher, and Tony Norris, a musician, built an apartment for themselves downstairs to make room for their extended family.
Now here's what Sue suggested that I play. Carpets up off of the floor. Put on your overcoat, get out the door, because it's moving.
All over the country, newcomers are moving to scenic communities like Flagstaff and helping to drive up housing costs. Many of the towns are trying desperately to create more affordable housing. Aspen, Colorado now requires developers to make 60% of new homes affordable, but these efforts simply can't keep up with the demand. And it's not just daycare workers, teachers, and firefighters who are squeezed out of the housing market in Flagstaff. Medical professionals and college professors can't afford it either.
You know, I was aware that it was much more expensive, but I was a deer caught in the headlights when we actually moved there.
Baylor Del Rosario came to Flagstaff for a tenure-track job as a special education professor at Northern Arizona University, but he left after only 1 year.
And I wasn't joking when I said, well, to even enter the real estate market in Flagstaff, I would need to be paid twice what I was getting, which was about $100,000.
Instead, Del Rosario took a job with the Las Cruces, New Mexico Public School District. It paid about the same, but there, he was able to buy a house. Salaries at Northern Arizona University are the lowest in the state system. Every year, dozens of employees leave because of the cost of living. So NAU is trying something that has worked for other colleges in high-cost areas, including several California state universities. It's planning to build homes for its faculty and staff. University Vice President Rich Bowen says the school would retain ownership of the land and sell the houses for far below market price.
The marketplace may not provide the solution. I think the key is that if we do beautiful homes that are still affordable, you can have something that would be an example, a demonstration to the community of what's possible.
Flagstaff and towns like it around the country are creating similar affordable housing programs. They're also doing their best to attract businesses with better-paying jobs, with high-tech incubators, tax breaks, improved roads and airports. But it's not enough to keep many longtime residents from leaving. Aaron Fullerton drives 60 miles twice a day through the empty desert between Flagstaff and Winslow, Arizona. Fullerton grew up in Flagstaff and still works there. But when it came time to buy his first home, he bought in Winslow for $150,000.
$150,000 in Flag? You'd be lucky to get an apartment that's been remodeled and called a townhome.
His new 2,000-square-foot home is on a barren, windswept 7 acres just south of town.
You know, it's not Flag, but I'm happy with what I've bought. But who knows? I mean, who knows if I'll ever be able to move anywhere near Flag.
Demographer Kenneth Johnson of the University of New Hampshire says this trend is playing out across the country in what he calls amenity regions. These are scenic communities in the mountains, on the coast, and in college towns that have lured more than 1 million newcomers since 2000.
As the very prime places become unaffordable to anybody but the very rich, people start saying, well, what's the next prettiest place? You know, where do we get the next prettiest view? Or what's the next prettiest lake that we can afford? And so there's a constant sort of sprawl, if you will, going on in many of these areas.
Indeed, the very fastest growing rural areas are now the affordable outskirts of super trendy amenity towns like Jackson Hole, Wyoming, or Park City, Utah. Places like Aaron Fullerton's new home, Winslow. Just 10 years ago, Winslow was run down and losing population.
When we moved here and had friends come out with us, they just thought we were out of our heads.
Former Mayor Alan Affeldt came to Winslow from Southern California to restore a landmark hotel, La Posada.
Downtown was largely abandoned, and like a lot of these Route 66 towns, it had been turned over to drunk bars. So at 1 o'clock at night, it was like Night of the Living Dead. You know, they closed the bars, people staggered out, there were fights in the streets, and intoxicated street people everywhere.
Since then, Affeldt's ongoing makeover of his hotel has spearheaded a renaissance in Winslow. Rundown buildings have been rehabbed into shops and art galleries. Hundreds of people have moved here from Flagstaff, and new businesses have sprung up to serve the growing population. A department store, a car dealership, a super Walmart. The local hospital expanded and built the first new major medical building in decades. Like other newcomers in other towns, Alan Affelt and his wife are helping transform Winslow into the place where they want to live.
We put down roots here. I think most Americans are kind of groundless because we move all the time, because we're not attached to a place. And there's something very compelling about this particular place, and it's become our home.
Unlike many Flagstaff old-timers, Winslow residents have mostly embraced the changes in their town. By 2020, Winslow's population is projected to double. That will be just in time for millions of retiring baby boomers who'll be looking for small, sunny towns surrounded by natural beauty, towns like Winslow, to call home. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Crocker.
Flagstaff is not the only vacation spot undergoing big changes, and you can find a map of similar areas across the country at our website, npr.org. Teresa Bierer, Mark Herz, Laurel Morales, and Jeff Norcross also contributed to this series. It was produced by Arizona Public Radio as part of NPR's Local News Initiative. That's a partnership between NPR and many of the local stations that bring you this program, and it brings you stories about America that you won't get anywhere else.